Excuse me, at this time I would like to inform all participants today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. And I'd like to turn today's call over to Ms. Trina Ray. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you. Well, I'd like to welcome everybody to the Charm Telecon for this month. We've got a fantastic topic today. It's one that you all suggested when I took ideas a few Charm Telecons ago. I wrote down a whole bunch of suggestions, and one of them was a spacecraft tutorial. And today we're joined by Julie Webster, who is the Cassini Spacecraft Operations Manager, and she'll have a wonderful talk for us on the spacecraft. Just a few reminders about the telecon. If you don't have mute capability on your phone, that's okay. Press *6 at any time to mute and unmute. If you have any trouble at all, press *0, and the operator will come on and help you. And Julie is welcome to take questions during the actual talk. And with that, I will go ahead and turn it over to Julie.
Okay, this is, of course, my favorite subject. I've been working on Cassini since 1995. I started back in the assembly, test, and launch operations phase. So I hope today I've got a few unique pictures for you that were taken during that time to just kind of give you a different perspective. You know, when the scientists put out their beautiful pictures and things like that, and the engineers look at all the wiring and electronics and the assembly that had to be put together to take that picture. So I've tried to arrange it with picture words, and I'm going to try to use the words to talk to the picture before. If this worked out, in hindsight, I probably should have done it the other way, but this will go.
Julie, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you have a bad connection.
I was going to ask you, are you on a phone, or can you pick up the handset?
I just picked up the handset. Is that better?
Much better.
Pretty much the same.
Oh, good. Okay. It's pretty much the same?
Still bad.
It's much better here.
It's much better here, too. You know what, Julie? Hold on a sec. Let me go ask the operator if she can see any problem. Let's just hold on for a sec.
Okay.
I don't think it's a toll call. You see what it is when you have engineering problems?
Especially on telecommunications. It stops everything.
That's the ones you have if you're in a wonderful situation. It certainly got better. I mean, it's perfect here. I guess maybe it's not so good up where the other. I think if you're on a speakerphone, sometimes it's not so good. I don't know.
Yeah, I she told me to pick up the handset, but apparently it's not much better.
I think it's better, but it's not like, you know, perfect. There's still some kind of crackling you hear. Is that what the other person's experiencing, the crackling?
I was getting some crackling too. It seems like when she went to the handset, though, it got better.
Yeah, I agree with both statements.
Okay, well, let's hope Trina solves the crackling or handset problem.
See if she can bring some cookies, too.
Okay, the operator's going to come take a look at it.
Pretty marvelous. This can even happen. I mean.
Oh, it's amazing. Well, the entire Cassini mission is basically driven by telecons. We have so many telecons because our scientists are spread out all over the
world.
All the engineers are co-located at JPL and basically in one building. But I routinely, from my office, will call into a telecon that's just, you know, down the hallway.
You want to try again?
Okay. You want to? Are you working with the operator, Julie?
No. Was I supposed to?
She was going to take a look at your line.
Okay.
And see if whether she thought you should call back in or whether she thought.
I can certainly do that. That's easy.
Yeah. I wonder what she would recommend. I guess we could hold on a sec.
Okay.
It is interesting because the local lady in Southern California, I guess, or wherever, his voice is much clearer than Julie's, so there is a difference for some reason.
No, that's because I'm calling from home. I'm sure that's just the whole atmosphere. Calling from home, you get a better connection.
Maybe that's why I'm hearing you better, too.
I'd have to say Julie calls in from her office to telecons that are right down the hallway, too. I know. I've seen it happen.
Trina, this is Jane. A lot of people, when they mute on and off, also, you know, if they go back and forth a lot, that creates a little blip. And actually, when we're writing the transcripts, that makes it almost impossible sometimes because the operator, the transcript, all they hear is the bleeps all the time. So people should try to also just keep the mute on when they're listening to the talk and then ask questions at the end or whatever.
Okay, so we'll save our questions to the end.
No, I don't think so. We can ask questions.
Well,
if you do, just be sure that you mute, you know, not with frequency.
All right.
Who is this asking all these questions?
Oh, Ron, I didn't ask all of them, but I asked a lot of them. Ron Ignelzi.
And are you a solar system ambassador?
Yes.
Great. Thanks. So, Jane, were you hearing Julie okay before?
I was hearing Julie just fine. I think we should just go ahead and...
Excuse me, this is the coordinator. I have placed Ms. Webster back to conference, and her line is much better at this time.
Oh, excellent. Do we need to start the recording over? Or is it still going?
It's still going right now.
Would it be okay if we sort of stopped it and restarted it so that it's a nice, clean recording? Is that possible?
Yes, we can go ahead. I can go ahead and we can disconnect that and go ahead and redo it after the call has ended. We'll just go ahead and record it now, and then we can go ahead and fix that for you.
Oh, okay. That's fine also. Okay,
all right.
Then
so
we'll
can
just
go
let
ahead
Julie
and,
go ahead.
Then we can go ahead and figure it out. Once you start over again, we can figure that out on our end.
Okay, do I need to start all over, or can you just cut out all the conversation about bad telecom?
I guess we should just start from scratch.
Okay. Again, I've been on Cassini since 1995, so I started back in the assembly, test, and launch operations phase. And what I was trying to show with the pictures today, I hope I got some unique pictures, was how engineers look at the spacecraft in terms of the buildup of it instead of just the pretty pictures. So anyway, on page 3, we are the largest outer... again, I've been on Cassini since 1995, so I started back in the assembly, test, and launch operations phase. And what I was trying to show with the pictures today, I hope I got some unique pictures, was how engineers look at the spacecraft in terms of the buildup of it instead of just the pretty pictures. So anyway, on page 3... we are the largest outer planetary spacecraft ever built. I believe, and I have never verified this, and I've given this in many, many talks, that Phobos, the Russian spacecraft that went to Mars that had problems in the late 80s, was actually a larger spacecraft. At launch, we weighed 5,600 kilograms, and of that, to the 3,100 kilograms of the was just pure propellant. Today we're down to just 422 of that 3,132 left after three major maneuvers and dozens of smaller maneuvers. We do have 58 microprocessors on board, which is pretty amazing. Every instrument has its own microprocessor. Several of the attitude control system have microprocessors, and of course there's microprocessors that run the computer and the attitude flight computer. The 12 science instruments, and the only thing I want to put out here on the picture is the optical remote sensing. So the things that you get most of the time probably on these telecoms are the pictures, and the four cameras are located on what they call the remote sensing palette in the picture. So the cameras are all facing collinear, so you can get pictures from all four of the cameras for one spacecraft pointing. The fields and particles instruments are mostly collinear, over on the fields and particles palette, but they're also spread out around the spacecraft. So they're a little bit different there. The electronics in the spacecraft is mostly in, there's a 12-sided bay that's the upper equipment module where the louvers are shown, and I'll have a better picture of that later. JPL has almost always built their spacecraft in a bay configuration. I think we started out with an 8-bay for Voyager, and some of the Mariners, I think, were like 6 bays. We were up to 12 bays, so I think they were the most bays of that in terms of a kind of a circular configuration that JPL's ever flown. Okay, so the first thing,
a bay is a side of?
It's a side. You know, like an octagon, like an 8-sided would be like a stop sign.
Okay.
And so we are a 12-sided, a dodecahedron, is that correct? Or is that 20?
Yes.
I never can remember.
You're right, but are we looking at the picture on page?
Page 2, yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'll go into quite a bit of details on the next grouping. There's 3 of the radioisotope thermoelectric generators, and those are shown in the cartoon around the bottom, and they have shields on the top of them to stop some of the heat going back in a different way than what we wanted on the spacecraft. So I'm going to go on to page 4. And
could I ask you a question about
sure.
the propellant, please? It's Ken Kramer from Princeton, New Jersey.
Uh-huh.
About the propellant, have you used, how much have you used in the past year since the Saturn orbit insertion?
Let me see. I've got that detail written right over here. In the past year, we've used a fair amount because we did what we called periapsis raise maneuver, and I'll show that in a later slide. We were about two-thirds down in propellant before that periapsis raise maneuver, and so I'll go through a little bit of detail on that. If you want some additional details, I can also email you those
okay.
kind of things.
I will ask you that then.
Okay.
And one just last question about the instrument. Basically, everything is functioning normally on the spacecraft, right? There are no problems at this time?
There are no problems on this. It's been the most amazing spacecraft I've ever worked on.
Yeah.
Okay. Page 4 is the picture of the radioisotope thermoelectric generator. Page 5 is the details. We started out with 3 what we call RTGs. We had about 875 watts of power at launch. If you think about it, that's less than half of your hair dryer. Of course, that's a little misleading because your hair dryer is on a 110-volt system and we're on a 30-volt system. But it's still an amazing amount of not very much power to run this whole spacecraft. The RTGs themselves, we get heat from the radioactive decay, and that heat's turned into power. Of course, as the more they decay, the less heat they produce. So we lose about 1 watt a month, and so we're down to today about 721 watts. So we've lost 150 watts since launch, and we'll continue to lose that. It's about 9 watts a year starting around 2007. The excess power that we still have out of all the small amount of power, we still have excess power, and that's distributed out to a shunt radiator, and I'll point that out in one of the later pictures. I think Solar Thermal Vac has a good picture of the shunt radiator, and then it's just radiated out to space. One of the major upgrades on Cassini, as opposed to like a Galileo or a Magellan or the Voyagers or some of the early Earth spacecraft, is that we have the power is distributed to the electronics and the instruments through 192 solid-state power switches. And these are the solid-state power switches are like little circuit breakers. This, for me, this was a major step forward in the engineering because relays, we used to use relays, and so we, you know, if you had a critical thing, you would put 4 relays on it, and you'd have to close 2 different relays to get the power through the electronics. And relays we were always worried about relays sticking or relays frying together or other things about faulty relays. So these power switches have been a major upgrade for us. The critical loads you know, we try to make the spacecraft idiot-proof, even for us. So all the critical loads have redundant switches and automatic turn-on circuitry. So if the spacecraft is on, they're on, and a lot of things that we've never turned off since we first powered the spacecraft at launch. There's special fall protection involved. We worry about these switches. Occasionally, they just, if they're off or on, they tend to just trip off, not for an overcurrent situation, but because of a faulty design. And we've uploaded special fall protection for these cases. The other thing that's unique about the power system is that we do not have enough power to keep all the instruments on all the time. We keep 10 of the 12 at any given time, but not all 12. The radar and radio science guys tend to be high power draws, so we go into certain operational modes to be able to carry. So we say if you want radars on, these instruments have to be in sleep, these instruments have to be off, et cetera, et cetera. Let's see, I don't think there's anything else. Okay, I'm on to page, with the next page is a picture of the 1750A processor, the microprocessor that's actually the main computer chip on the spacecraft. So the engineering flight computer, the command and data system, we have two identical flight computers. And of course, when you send an asset, a spacecraft like this, out to Saturn, we do a lot of redundancy. Almost everything that's a critical item has a redundant. So we have a redundant computer. We have a redundant bus that distributes the computer out to the different electronics and the science subsystems. I think it's always kind of amazing that we only take 512. These computers are only 512K of RAM. You don't need a lot of processing power to run a spacecraft. We upload background sequences about every 3 to 6 weeks, and we put everything that's needed for the computer to fly for the next 3 to 6 weeks, and then sometimes we still need real-time commands, and those are uplinked during downlink passes that we'll talk about in a little while. Let's see, we do process all the telemetry for the spacecraft engineering subsystems and the instruments. When we're not in sight of a downlink station, we store the information and the pictures and the science data on two solid-state recorders. And each solid-state recorder is the 2.3 gigabits, and 2.1 is available for telemetry. On any given day, we only downlink probably a little bit less than 2 gigabits a day. I'm going on to the next is the propulsion system, and maybe I can answer some more prop questions on this one. We have two completely isolated systems. One's a monopropellant system, which is hydrazine, and hydrazine is put through a heated catalyst bed to rapidly expand and get us the small thrust. These are 1 Newton thrusters. We have four thrusters per cluster. And the cluster, if you look in the photograph, those are the lower items that look like little squares that are out on the black supporting struts. And there's one in each corner. We only use 8 at a time, and they're 2 downward facing, and then there's 2 outward facing in the Z direction. And between the down and the Z, between the downward facing and the outward facing in one direction, we can thrust the spacecraft in any direction we need to go. These small thrusters are used in what we call a blowdown mode. That means that they're pressurized to a certain thing using helium as a pressurant at launch. And since launch, they've been, of course, every time they thrust, they lower the pressure just a little bit. Because there's less gas in there, we started out with these at 1 Newton thrusters, and we're down now to about 0.65 newtons today. And the reason I'm going into a little bit of detail on this is a week from next Monday, on April 10th, we're actually going to fire We're actually going to fire a pyro device, and if you look at the picture, there's a small ball, and I have a helium recharge tank for monoprop. There's a small ball on the lower right part of the picture. We're actually going to fire a pyro that will open up that small ball of highly pressurized helium, and it'll go back into the large monoprop ball, and we'll pressurize these thrusters back up to 1 newtons. That gives us more attitude control authority for going very close to the Titan passes, so that we have more thrust capability to overcome Titan torques. Let's see, what else can we talk about that? Oh, we have a complete backup system. All of those thrusters have a redundant thruster with them. We have never gone to the backup redundant system in flight. The spacecrafts have been remarkably performing well. Now, the other system that's the larger thrust is a bipropellant system. It's nitrogen tetroxide and monomethylhydrazine. And we have main engines. The picture's not a very good picture for the main engines. I'm hoping I have a better picture later on, because of the support cages are in the way. But they're kind of the blue-gray nozzles down at the bottom of the picture, if you look carefully. These are 445-newton engines, or just large thrusters. And they're used. There's only one engine that we've ever used. We've only used Engine A, but because you go out to Saturn after 7 years, you don't want an engine failure to stop you from going into orbit. We carried a backup engine, and we still have that backup engine available to us should anything happen with the main engine. The biprop also is mostly used in a blowdown mode, in terms of that it was pressurized, except for real long burns. And for long burns, like a Saturn orbit insertion, or the periapsis raise maneuver, or the deep space maneuver, that are very, very long, over several minutes, 5 up to maybe 90 minutes burn, those are all done in a regulated mode, and we have a regulator that provides a constant pressure to the engines so that we get the same thrust throughout the maneuver. The engines, it wasn't really an afterthought, but late in the design game, they came back with some worry about these two engines kind of hanging out in the breeze during the asteroid crossing, was our original concern. And so we put on an articulated baby buggy cover it has metal stays and thermal blanket material, several layers of thermal blanket material, and we actually articulate baby buggy this over the main engines during any dust hazards. We kept the engines covered almost all the time in cruise, and only opened it when we wanted to do a trajectory correction maneuver. In tour, we tend to do just the opposite. We leave it open, except for dust hazard crossings where we get near the E-ring, I believe, and where we go into the closer into the rings where we're worried about dust hazards, we'll close the cover at that time.
Okay. Julie, because yes. You obviously have a problem if the dust cover never opened, you take a special precautions to make sure it will open under all circumstances?
Absolutely. Engineers are nothing if not cautious. There's two motors. There's two driving motors for this. You can use either motor, A or B, or you can use both if there's an issue with driving the material. And in the worst case condition, since it's easier to avoid dust hazards than it is to not fire a trajectory, you can also blow this off. We can blow the cover off with a pyrofire should we need to. And we always keep that option in the back of our mind.
Thank you. That was my question, if you had one.
Yeah.
Of those last chance things.
And actually, in 98, 99, we actually had quite a change in where the cover opened to because of the stiffness of the material after it's been out in flight for a while. And we watched that very closely. Since then, it's kind of settled into the same. It opens up about two-thirds of the way. It doesn't get quite all the way up like it used to anymore. And that's still good enough to fire the main engines. But we watch that every single time when we close and open the cover. All right. Let's go on. Now, the workhorse subsystem, of course, every subsystem thinks they're the most important subsystem. But attitude control is the essential thing for science. We have to be able to point the spacecraft reliably, we have to point it accurately, and we have to point it very stable, should we need to. The attitude control system, the picture is kind of showing that the attitude control system is distributed all over the spacecraft. At the top, and I don't think I wrote that in the words, but there's two holes in the high-gain antenna, and those are where the sun sensors go. So the very first thing this spacecraft does, if it doesn't know where it's at, the flight software on board tells it to go find the sun. So it will turn the spacecraft in a slow motion around until it gets the sun in the field of view of the sun sensors going through the high gain. And then it tries to find stars. So the actual attitude determination is done by what we call stellar reference units. And what these are basically very, very fancy cameras with CCDs, charge couple devices, where they're comparing against all the time against an onboard star catalog. We have about a 3,500 star catalog. And so it takes a picture, it picks out the four or five brightest stars in the field of view at any given time, and it tries to match it up to its star catalog to make sure that it knows where it's at. If it can't find more than three stars, it starts a search program that it will continue to try and move around until it can find those four or five brightest stars at any given time. Now, the stellar reference unit still, it can be spoofed on occasion. If there's bright bodies, like Saturn is a bright body, Titan is a bright body, even the reflection off the rings is sometimes considered a bright body. So it can be spoofed into seeing brighter bodies than the stars that we want it to see. And so during that time, we may tell it not to look for stars for a minute to a few hours, and we hold the attitude control by gyroscopes or inertial reference units. And we have two, although we only use one, hemispheric resonator gyros, and that's how we hold the attitude if we can't pick it up with the SRU. And then the attitude rates are supplied by the gyros all the time. And if the stellar reference unit is working, it updates the attitude rate and determination into the gyros constantly. Their attitude control, there's two ways to hold the spacecraft stable. We are a three-axis stabilized spacecraft. And we can either stabilize the spacecraft and hold the pointing control with the thrusters, the little thrusters, and we tend to thrust around what they call a dead band. So we normally use a 2 milliradian, what they call a dead band. So for plus and minus 2 milliradians, remember 17 milliradians is a degree. So it's an eighth of a degree or so between a quarter of a degree by the time you go plus and minus two, we tend to bounce back and forth. So we let the spacecraft drift, and then if it comes up against the edge of being 2 milliradians off its perfect pointing, it'll fire a thruster to force it back towards the ideal position that they want. And then it'll go back the other way, and we'll fire thruster the other way, and we'll kind of deadband. We'll just bounce back and forth between those two areas. That's perfectly okay for a lot of spacecraft and science data taking, but it's not usually good enough for the cameras. And for the cameras, we go on the reaction wheel control. There's three reaction wheels, and they're around the, basically there's three spaced around the bottom of the spacecraft, and there's one that was up on the upper equipment module that was a spare reaction wheel. The reaction wheels are nothing but, they're kind of a spinning magnet. They kind of make a heavy, if you think of it as a top, you know, where tops always try to correct to an attitude, and we put electronic impulses into these RWAs to cause a torque, to cause torque and cause it to change attitude per whatever the spacecraft is supposed to point at the time. These reaction wheels are, as you've seen on the pictures, they're incredible. They provide better than 100 microradians. Usually it's down in the 50-60 microradians region over 1,000 seconds. And that is even in fact, the spacecraft is going several kilometers per second. We still hold that pointing control with the reaction wheels. I mentioned the fourth wheel. We carry a spare. We didn't carry three spares because of the expense and the weight, but we carried one spare that could be moved into position to replace any one of the three prime wheels. And in July of 2003, we actually had to do that. We had a wheel that the bearings on it started rattling and causing us a lot of friction, kind of like a hot spot on your air. And we saw enough degradation that we went to the fourth wheel. We put it in place of the third prime wheel, and we've been running on that combination of 1, 2, 4 since July of 2003. Anything else I didn't tell you about the attitude control system? The attitude control system has its own flight computer. It talks to the command and data system to receive commands from that, and also to send it back its telemetry. But the other flight computer, the attitude flight computer, takes complete care of attitude control, and it can run basically on its own once it's given a target to go to.
Julie, I have a question about a reaction wheel. In other spacecraft, we often hear that when that fails, that's the end of mission, and it's a mission-critical assembly. It's also one of the few things that seems to have to be a mechanical solution to the need in a spacecraft. Is there something in the future that may replace reaction wheels that you can envision, or do you think this is what you'd be using for generations to come?
Boy, not that I know of. I think the reaction wheels are going to be basically used for generations to come. I think the trick is in the manufacturer and how good, and they're getting better with the lubricants. Cassini had some stabilizing chemicals put in its lubricant to make it last longer and work better. There's, you know, of course, with any ball bearing assembly, it's absolutely critical how well you polish the ball bearings is how well they work in flight. So I don't know of anything that's coming down the pike to replace reaction wheels. I do know that they ought to be a good chunk of your budget because you're right. When they fail, if we were to lose another wheel. Well, now, let me back up a second. To us, it looked like we had some problems. We never, ever, with wheel three, had a pointing control issue. It's just that it was chattering more than we wanted it to. And we've got lots of telemetry on these wheels, probably more than most spacecraft. I mean, we actually watch a lot of the friction spikes that most spacecraft don't even have instrumented. So we could actually go back to reaction wheel 3 and use it. We just assume that its life, you know, span has been degraded. But you're right, they are a limiting factor. Now we could drop to an all thruster mission, but that would shorten the length of the mission and it would certainly degrade the pictures quite a bit. Okay, the next picture, I'm an old telecom engineer, so this is, I always do more on telecom than I do on any other subsystem. This picture on page 12 is one that was taken during the assembly and test phase. They actually, at the time, you can see the technicians that are squatting are actually installing part of the radio plasma wave system, which those red canisters were the covers before flight of the radio RPWS antennas. But what I wanted to show here was that this is a four-frequency antenna. So this is used by the engineering subsystem for the commanding, sending up commands, and getting back telemetry. It's used, the Doppler on the X-band is used by navigation to navigate the spacecraft. And we also have an S-band frequency that's used for radio science. It's in the neighborhood of about 2 gigahertz. The X-band, which is the workhorse frequency, is about 8 gigahertz. But you also have the Ka-band, which is another radio science experiment, which is, again, about 4 times higher than the X-band, which is about 32 gigahertz. And then radar. Radar also uses the high gain as the antenna for them. They use a different, they use the parabolic dish slightly differently, and the little things down in the middle that looks like two wings that are the little five darker gray spots, those are actually, there's five on each side, those are actually the beams that send out the radar pulse and then receive the echo. So I was trying to kind of show you that. On top of the high gain antenna is the low gain. The struts are holding out the low gain, which is basically a choked waveguide, and we use that for emergency communications. The next page that I wanted to describe is how we get command and data back from the Earth. You've probably had or know some talks on the Deep Space Network, but just to remind you that the Deep Space Network comprises of, there's three complexes, one in Barstow, California, one in Madrid, Spain, and one outside of Canberra, Australia. And each complex has the big 70-meter antenna, and then they each have multiple 34-meter antennas. The 34-meter antennas are the workhorse. And on any given day, we mostly have a 9-hour pass where we point the spacecraft to the Earth and have one of these 34-meter antennas receive the signal. I wrote in words on this picture quite a bit, but the most important thing is on the tracking and navigating the spacecraft. The DSN has a hydrogen-controlled Maser standard, and so it knows time very, very exactly, and therefore it knows frequency very, very exactly. So they send up a signal to the spacecraft, and the spacecraft, a transponder, turns the signal around. It multiplies it by an exact amount. In this case, it's 880/749, and it forms a coherent downlink. And so that gives the radio and navigation radio science and navigation very, very precise two-way coherent Doppler in order to navigate this spacecraft. Let's see, the two low-gain antennas. We have the one low-gain antenna that I pointed out on top of the high-gain. The other low-gain antenna was located just below the probe. The probe's now missing, and the picture shows that it's not there anymore attached. The low-gain 2, when we were in intercruise, which we'll show you in just a few minutes, we had to use, the high gain was used as a sun shield. And so we had to communicate out through the two low gain, antennas. And so they were 90 degrees apart on the spacecraft. This is a classic, it's a Cassini model, but it's a classic deep space transponder. Motorola-built deep space transponder where the uplink bit rates can go from 7.8125 up to 500 in an exact multiple, so it's 500, 250, 125, etc. The downlink rates can be anywhere from 14, not the 22 I have on the page, 14 to 165 kilobits. But if we fall to the low gain at Saturn ranges, we have to drop down to 5 bits a second in order to receive the signal on the ground. Let's go to the next page. The next page is the Cassini spacecraft being readied. This is a classic picture. I'm sure you've all seen it if you've looked at the website at all. We were getting prepared for solar thermal vac, the solar thermal vacuum test. That's the most important test for the whole spacecraft. If you pass solar thermal vacuum, that's when you're really what we consider flight space qualified. And this chamber, this 25-foot circular chamber that the Cassini spacecraft is inside, there's big doors after they get finished preparing it, and they close, and they can turn on, they turn on huge arc lamps down in the basement, and then they focus them very precisely with mirrors at the top of this chamber. And this can be made to simulate anywhere from sun at Saturn, which is at like a tenth of a sun, or it can simulate 2.3 suns, like a Venus. And, of course, since we had to go both Venus and Saturn, we had to be prepared for both. They close the chamber, lock it down, bring it down to... They form a vacuum in there, so they draw out all of the ambient air, and then they start running liquid nitrogen down those back panels, black panels that surround it. They start running liquid nitrogen down that wall to simulate a space environment. Now, even the liquid nitrogen in there wasn't cold enough for some of the targets. For the cameras, for example, the Sears telescope had to be colder than liquid nitrogen. So during solar thermal vacuum test, we put in a very special helium-cooled target to get liquid helium to get down to the almost absolute coldest we could actually get. To maintain these, there's a thermal system involved. And what we have, there's two parts of the thermal system. There's the passive components, which is the thermal blankets and surface treatments like the optical surface reflectors that are like mirrors that would reflect back any heat. And then there's the radiators that I just described that would face cold sky that needed the liquid helium target to be able to verify that it functioned correctly. And the active components, if you look very carefully up on the 12-sided bay area, there's the shiny metal things that kind of look like curtain slats. Those are the louvers that are on some of the electronics bays, and they're louvers that they work exactly like your thermostat in your house. If it gets too warm, they open the louvers to outer space. If it gets too cold, they close the louvers and hold the heat in within the spacecraft. So there's two really big things on this spacecraft that were a major step forward, and the thermal system's one of them. It's amazing, but from Venus distances all the way out to Saturn distances, we've maintained the temperature of that 12-sided bay within 10 degrees of room temperature at all times. So it's run in degrees centigrade. It's run anywhere from 20 to 35 degrees the whole time in flight. And that's pretty amazing. I've worked on spacecraft that had thermal problems, and it's hard to work with once they get stuck. There is autonomous thermal control that where they turn on if they get too cold and turn off if they get too hot. And then because the instruments get turned on and off by operational modes or just the time in flight, we also have replacement heaters to keep them because they tend to be more decentralized from the central body of the spacecraft. We have replacement and supplemental heaters to keep them from getting too cold. We use, I was pointing out the RTG, the radio thermal generators, the sunshade shades, those are to keep the waste heat from the RTGs from going back into the spacecraft and radiating more heat than the instruments want to see. We also use the waste heat to come back into the center core and keep the propellants warm. And that was another, major design for us on this spacecraft. Okay, so we're back up. I just threw the launch picture in because I like the launch picture.
Excuse me, I have one question.
Sure.
This is John Vitello, Solar System Ambassador in Park Ridge, Illinois.
Uh-huh.
Was Huygens and the probe and the spacecraft rated the same planetary protection category?
That's a good question. I don't know that exactly, because the planetary protection for the probe itself was handled by the Europeans. Trina, do you know on that one?
No, I don't. I can only assume that the probe, because you knew it was landing on Titan, and you knew that Titan is very interesting from a planetary protection point of view, had very high standards that I would not assume the orbiter had. But, you know, I don't know that for sure. And I'm not even sure who to ask. Maybe Spahalski.
Yeah. there are some planetary protection information. If you email Trina, we'll get that information out to you.
Great, because I know it's listed as Category 2, but with the I'm getting a lot of questions with the water being discovered in Enceladus, so I just wanted to make sure I knew what the story was.
Yeah. One of the things, you know, with the Enceladus water, just like the Io on Jupiter, we'll be very careful at the end of Cassini's life that we don't can't encounter or hit any of the other moons for that exact reason, because they are interesting scientifically and we don't want to contaminate them in any way. Let's see. Okay, so we had this incredibly long 7-year cruise, and you think, well, gosh, what do you do for 7 years? But it turns out that we actually wound up with a lot to do. We launched with fairly minimal flight software because we knew we had 7 years to develop. We started out with the spacecraft that had pretty simple command and telemetry systems, not real fancy. We couldn't go back and forth, what we call ping pong, on one SSR to the other SSR. We only ever used one SSR at a time. We could only do thruster control. We didn't have the flight software to control the reaction wheels, and we didn't need to because there wasn't that much we were doing in early cruise. One of the things that we've done 4 times in flight with the attitude control system and 3 times in flight with the CDS, with the command and data system, is we have actually switched operating systems on the spacecraft on the fly. And those of you that change operating systems on your computers know what a nerve-wracking system that is. Imagine having to do that at long distance and just hope it works when you can hear it back. One of the things, the very first thing they did, when they first came to me and said they were going to do this, I said they were nuts. But within 3 days of launch, we had switched both Prime CDS and AACS computers to change from launch to cruise parameters. So we kind of did I'm a Macintosh person, so we did an OS 9 to 9.1 at that time. And then we had to stay on the low gain again because the high gain had to be pointed at the sun at all times. We used the two low gains to communicate with Earth, which kept our bit rates very, very low. During most of the first 3 years of cruise, we were at 40 bits a second or lower of data. And we also, in the early checkout, we had a lot of launch latches that held some instruments. We had to puncture membranes. We had to deploy the radio plasma antennas. We had to check out the backup units and make sure that they were viable we did a probe checkout within the first 3 months to make sure the probe was functioning and had survived launch. And we did an instrument checkout. We did instrument of all the instruments except the ion and neutral mass spectrometer because it required a cover release that we weren't going to do until much, much later. In fact, just before SO Saturn orbit insertion was when we finally did that one. And the radio frequency, the radio science system, because that required the high gain. Okay, then, our trajectory, of course, we were too heavy to go on a direct path to Saturn. And so we had to do this fancy Venus, Earth, Jupiter gravity assist. So the first thing we had to do, as soon as we launched, we had to fly and catch up with Venus and then swing by Venus very close so that they would give us a gravity assist, kind of a boost in speed. And we did that on April 26th of 1998. We flew above Venus at an altitude of 284 kilometers, and we did some science calibrations. One of the things that we engineers assumed incorrectly, as it turned out, but for the good of us all, is that we were going to fly a rock. We were going to be very, very careful with this, and we weren't going to do a lot of science. And, of course, as the scientist, as soon as they found that we had an incredibly healthy spacecraft and everything was working well, they wanted to take science calibrations. And so we did radar and radio plasma at Venus. And then the Venus, the first gravity assist gave us quite a boost, but we had to come back in to catch the second Venus gravity assist. So we were flung out along the red path on the interplanetary trajectory picture after Venus 1. And so when we got out to the furthest place away from the sun that we were going to go to in that orbit, we actually fired the engines in the deep space maneuver to slow ourselves down so that we could fall back into Venus 2. We actually did a 90-minute regulated burn, as I described, to hold constant pressure on the bipropellant system. And that gave us confidence that we could do Saturn orbit insertion and also get us back on the main trajectory. So there was a serendipitous time where Earth was in front of the sun from the spacecraft. And at that time, we were allowed to turn. Of course, the high gain was still facing the sun, but the Earth was right there so that we could use the high gain. And at that time, that's when we checked out the high gain data rates and the K-band and the S-band for the first time. And then a year and 2 months later, we went by Venus the second time in June of 1999 with some more science calibrations. And then less than 2 months later, 6 weeks later, we flew by the Earth. We did a pretty fancy Earth avoidance. So we actually had to zigzag our way in to flying by Earth. We would zigzag in, and then we would zag back out, and then we'd zig in, and then we'd zig out just to make sure that we were not going to accidentally hit the Earth if things didn't work right. It was 2000 before we actually switched on to permanent high gain. We were finally past we were well past the Earth at that point, and we could actually switch and use the high gain as pointing it to Earth instead of the sun. And that's when we could finally use the science data rates. And then at that time, we were ready with a whole new operating system for both AACS and CDS to give the reaction wheel capability. So we didn't actually turn the wheels on and use them to control the spacecraft until March of 2000. Of course, at that time, once we had the reaction wheels, and the scientists were really clamoring for lots of pictures of Jupiter. And so we started a chance to give us the tour sequencing capabilities out, and the science took pictures, I guess, for plus and minus, 6-month campaigns, plus or minus 3 months before and after Jupiter, taking a lot of the fancy pictures that I'm sure you've seen on the website if you followed Jupiter. And then from January 2001 until July of 2004, we were just out taking the rest of the orbit. I think, we did another flight, again, another operating system flight software load in February and April of 2004. And then we did it again in 2005. Let me go on to the picture.
Julie, I had one question about the Venus flyby.
Uh-huh.
You mentioned that in that chamber, it went to up to, I guess, 2.3 suns.
2.3 suns. That's Venus. That's what Venus sees compared to our sun.
Okay. So it, the heat is really from the sun itself and not from Venus's atmosphere? Is that...
That's correct. We didn't actually go close enough to get into their atmosphere enough to get much heating from them.
Thank you.
Yeah. It was mostly from the sun's effects. Okay. Now, once we went into orbit in July of 2004, then the very first thing that we had to do was get back and get ready for the probe mission. So, as you see, and this was the question about the bipropellant and the firing of the main engines. Let's see if I found my notes in the meantime on that. Right. So the periapsis raise maneuver. So we got into orbit, but now we were flung into this very long 170, 180 day orbit. And we got out to orbit one in the 23 August 2004 and did the periapsis raise maneuver. And for that, we actually then, it was to raise periapsis. We never wanted to go that close to Saturn again. We didn't want to go through those rings like we did the first time. We had to go through the rings in order to let Saturn's gravity catch us and fling us into an orbit. But we never wanted to go that close again. So we got way out at periapsis raise maneuver and again fired our engines to slow ourselves down so that we would fall back into a smaller orbit. We were actually, at Saturn, we were going thousands of kilometers per second. And at periapsis raise maneuver, we were actually measuring tens and hundreds of meters per second. That's how slow we were in that orbit. We came back around again and we started doing several things. We did an A and a Titan B, but during this, what this picture on page 23 is really trying to show is we did very special maneuvering to try and get to the probe targeting, to get the probe targeting maneuver so that we could release the probe. And then we had to clean up out of that probe separation on the 24th of December. And then we had to do an orbit deflection because, remember, we had to put the whole spacecraft and the probe where we would both hit Titan. And then we released the probe so that it became this flying saucer that landed on Titan. But we didn't want to hit Titan, so we did an orbit deflection maneuver. That's what the ODM stands for us to come out and fly by Titan at a much greater distance. We actually went by Titan at 60,000 kilometers. If you remember, there was a problem with the radio on the probe, and we had to take out the effects of Doppler. We originally planned to fly by at like 1,300 kilometers and whiz by with the Doppler. Instead, we had to go a very large, high Titan maneuver to stay away from in order to knock off the Doppler effects when we took the probe data. Okay, so...
Hey, Julie, I had a question.
Sure.
This is Trina. I always have told people, and I don't know if it's true, so you can tell me right now if I've been lying for years, that in the history of the mission, we were only on a collision course twice with a body. Once was the one you just mentioned, a collision with Titan, but that when we launched, we were deliberately put on a collision course with Venus before... So that if we had completely lost control of the spacecraft, it wouldn't have come around and smacked into the Earth, that we were deliberately put on a collision course for Venus. Is that right?
Pretty close, because we actually only did two trajectory corrections to get past Venus, and the trajectory correction maneuver one was to just raise us up a little bit away from Venus. And then we didn't have to do another course correction. But we actually really weren't on a Venus impactor for very long. We were for
does it make for a good
month?
Story, you know?
About a month. We were a Venus impactor for about a month.
There you go. See, okay. It makes for a very good story.
Yes, it does. You're right. The picture 24 is just that. I like that picture. You know, engineers always like pictures of what it really looks like. This is the actual, this is a probe engineering model that was used in a drop test in Norway to actually drop the probe out of a plane flying way out in order to see the parachutes deploy. You can see the parachute lines there. And that's probably not unlike what the probe looks like on Titan right now, sitting there. It's probably a little bit darker from the methane than it is in this picture, but it looks pretty close to probably what it would really look like if we could get a good picture of it on Titan. I won't go into the details of the. I'm sure if you had a talk the probe plus 1 year a month ago, you've been hearing about the probe, so I'm not going to go into any details on that. The next picture.
Excuse me, I have a probe question.
Sure.
The problem that was experienced with the Doppler with that was identified after launch, obviously, and you took steps to correct it. In retrospect and in analysis, was this a very, very serious problem or moderate serious? Were you being overly cautious, or was it an absolute deal killer for getting the data out?
It was an absolute deal killer. The problem was, It was like you're having your FM radio, and where it couldn't suddenly shift, like your FM car on your radio, and you're driving along, and you're going up and down over the hills, and your radio constantly adjusts for the signal level so that you don't get blasted out when it's really good signal, and you don't get really quiet when it goes away as a bad signal. And it actually couldn't. It was designed to vary with the Doppler, but it didn't. The tracking loop just was about less than half of what it was supposed to be, and so the signal would have gotten to the spacecraft. The S-band receiver would have been there. The carrier would have been there, but the data tracking loop just failed to perform over the frequency change of the Doppler rates, and so it was a deal killer. We discovered it. One of the things that engineers like to do is always the end-to-end test. And back in March of 2000, when we finally went on high gain in a permanent manner, the probe guys and we certainly agreed, because we hadn't seen a full end-to-end maneuver. Ask us for a special test. They ask us to make the deep space network act like a probe receiver, act like the spacecraft probe receiver, and receive the probe data in exactly the manner that it was going to that the Cassini spacecraft was going to receive the probe data coming from the probe. So we set up a special test, and there's a radio engineer who works for a European Space Agency that I can't speak highly enough for. It was Boris Schmedz that designed this test, and we all said, "Oh, we don't need the data. We don't need the data." And he kept saying, "I can do the data." And of course, by adding the data and finishing this true end-to-end test, he found the flaw, and we wouldn't have found it if we hadn't run this test. Why you can't do enough testing on the ground.
So you're saying that this was in fact missed by many, many teams of engineers, that this problem was, it really didn't come to a point error, it was just plain so...
Right, they just hadn't done that. Doing Doppler adjustments on the ground is hard. Because you have to, you have to switch, you have to change frequencies, and you have to put in a phase delay system, and so it's hard on the ground. We always try to do it to make sure that we can. I mean, most radios do this, but this was just one of those things that they thought they didn't need to do on the ground.
You see, that part of it's really never been explained. Is really exactly how the problem was uncovered and how the problem originated, with so many people thinking about it.
We discovered the problem in 2000 when we did a probe test, and we did a complete
end-to-end data link test. So we sent the probe signal back through the high gain from Cassini, and then the Deep Space Network, actually out here at Goldstone, we used one of the 34-meter sites to act like a probe receiver. And then we recorded the data, and we spent many months trying to figure out why we didn't get all the data we thought we got.
This is more of a systems engineering success than a systems engineering error, in that the system found it and fixed it.
It was, actually. I like to think of it that way. You never, again, and I'm an old ATLO test conductor, and you never can run enough tests. You keep hoping that you trap all the big items, but that's why during the whole 7 years, and even this year after Saturn orbit insertion, where you'd think we were pretty quiescent, we've done nothing but keep a test lab up and running, testing future sequences, testing future designs, testing future flight software even, to make sure that we haven't missed something that's going to bite us later.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. So the next picture is this fancy 76 orbit tour that goes all around Saturn in the what they call the petal plot. And so what the engineers are doing during this time, well, each of those orbits that goes around Saturn, actually around Titan, and then out to apoapsis and then back in, that each of those orbits, to maintain the orbit exactly as designed, takes 3 trim maneuvers. We do one at Titan 3 days before we approach Titan. We call that the approach maneuver. We do a maneuver at Titan plus 3 days. We clean up any effects that the Titan gravity or Titan atmosphere even might have given us that we didn't understand in advance. And then out at the furthest point out on each one of those loops from Saturn, we do an apoapsis maneuver, and that's used to start to target the next Titan and or to change the orbit size and angle that as it moves around. We also are responsible for, of course, the more we fly and the more we go by things, the better position knowledge we have. And since we had to design sequences years ago, we now have better knowledge of where the moons or the Saturn is that the scientists want to take pictures of. So we update vectors in real time, what we call live updates. We also have to do periodic engineering maintenance. Especially we have to exercise the moving parts, like the engine gimbal assemblies that move that main engine thruster around, to make sure that they stay lubricated. And if we encounter the E-ring dust hazards, we also have to articulate and close this engine cover. And then sometimes if the dust hazard is deemed serious enough by the people that know what serious enough means, we turn the high gain to the ram direction so that we fly through the dust high gain first and let it take the brunt of the force. And then one of the things that's interesting, once a year, the spacecraft and the Earth are on the opposite sides of the sun, and trying to send radio signals through the sun doesn't work very well. So we plan for about a 10-day quiet period on the spacecraft, because the telecommunications up and the telecommunications down are fairly severely disrupted during that time. And that's what we're doing to occupy our days now that we're in tour.
For those 3 maneuvers that you have to make each orbit, what
mm-hmm.
is the thrusters used, or the main engine, or the reaction wheels used?
It depends on what we're trying to do. Usually the approach maneuver, the Titan minus 3 days and the Titan plus 3 days, those tend to be thruster maneuvers. And actually, the navigators have done so well in this design that we frequently cancel those. We look at them as we get better navigation signals through there. But it just depends on what we're trying to do. Now, when we're trying to change that petal plot, where we're trying to move in a different, Trina, help me out here, the angle.
The inclination angle?
Inclination angle, thank you. we tend to have those. Those are more main engine maneuvers, what they call deterministic maneuvers. But we have used, in fact, we just did a main engine maneuver this past week. It was the first one that we had done since November, and it was not a very big one. It was actually about a 2.7 second burn, which isn't very long on these main engines.
Now, I have a follow-up question. So when these thruster maneuvers are going on for the Titan Minus and Titan Plus, are they automatically calculated by the spacecraft and you just kind of okay them down to the ground, or do you actually, you know, calculate them and send them up?
We calculate them and send them up. We don't do auto navigation, and we don't do automatic course correction. We build them on the ground based on the navigation, what the navigators say. You need to turn to this angle, and we want so much delta velocity, delta V, what we call, and so they'll want anything from a few millimeters a second to meters per second burn. If it's over half a meter per second, it has to be main engine. Under half a meter per second, it usually is the thruster burn. So we use these to do 1 to 300 millimeters per second course correction.
Can you give a range of the propellant use, and how much did you use for this main engine maneuver, please?
Oh, sure. The 2.7. You know what? Let me see if I have that in front of me. And of course, I don't. It was on the order of, for example, let me give you an example of a big one. Like the Saturn orbit insertion was a 96-minute burn, and it used about 530 kilograms of oxidizer, the nitrogen tetroxide, and about 320 kilograms of the monomethylhydrazine. And it scales down pretty close to that.
All right. So what would be typical for these approach or cleanup maneuvers?
They're on the order of tenths of kilogram.
What I'm trying to get at. Right?
Yeah, tenths of kilograms. Let me see. If you can hold on a second, I'll look up in my email if you're willing to hold for just a second and let me look this up. Let's do it. Barber. Well, this is going to take a minute, so
it's okay to find it later.
Okay. Yeah, I'd be glad to do that.
Sure. Can you just give us your email, please?
Julie, mm-hmm. J-U-L-I-E,
yep.
Dot L dot Webster, W-E-B-S-T-E-R.
Julie dot L dot Webster.
At JPL dot NASA dot gov.
That'll take care of it. Thank you.
And I'd be glad to answer any other, you know, engineering questions that I didn't go over in this presentation or anything else like that that you would be interested in.
Great.
I'm sorry, I got cut off and just came back. Are we through?
Almost. I'm at the page 28, so, you know, for more information, there's the Saturn website. And also, if you haven't gone out, if you're solar system ambassadors, you may have already seen this. But Dave Duty has a wonderful Basics of Space Flight that's out on the JPL public website, and it is a great description of what we have to do to fly spacecraft, basically.
Where
not
is
not
that
just
thing?
Cassini. It's on the JPL public website.
Yeah, where?
I'm not real sure. You can just it usually is from the main page. You can go in and search for Basics of Space Flight. What's
okay.
called?
Thank you.
Mhm. Okay.
Do the reaction wheels are they completely automated in terms of their use?
No. What we do is they're automated in terms of they know how to calculate how much electronic signal or force to put in to make a torque to take a change. So we tell the spacecraft to target Titan, for example, and that we want to continue to target Titan as we're flying by it. And so the reaction wheels get a torque input that keeps the spacecraft turning in the correct direction all the time. We bias the wheels to a certain speed. Most spacecraft do what we used to call them desaturations, where you spin up the wheels and eventually the wheels will spin fast and you stop and you go on thrusters and have the wheels spin down. We actually bias the wheels, and we tend to bias them every trajectory correction since we go on thrusters for either roll control on the main engine or we use the thrusters to do the small corrections. And then we let the wheels spin down to zero, and then we re-bias them to a certain speed to keep them out of the real slow RPM regions where we think we have more problems with lubricant, and then not above, so that the ideal reaction wheel speeds that we want at any given time is between 3 and 1,800 RPMs, revolutions per minute.
Thank you.
Julie, were there any things, this is a little far out, but I'm one of the ambassadors, and one of the areas I'm trying to promote are the medical advances made through the NASA technology. Can you get anything in this mission that might contribute to technology transfer or whatever towards the medical field, or at least medical science, in other words?
Well, in this specific area, no, but I believe that a lot of the spacecraft, a lot of the ways that we get signals, the way that we pick up signals, that we telemeter things like thermocouples for temperature and pick up signals of electronic, very small electronic impulses, I think that probably that's one of our greatest contributors is how to pick up, amplify, receive signals, vary signals, use it against a microprocessor to tell you if it's going high or low. You know, you can't check into the hospital today without being hooked up to a monitor.
Right.
And that's nothing but a sophisticated telemetry system that was really probably started in the auto industry, but really exploded in the field of the NASA spacecraft in general.
At NASA or JPL that actually, you know, has a link to, like, is there a section just on these advances or?
There is, and I don't know the website exactly, but there are people that are working on very specialized techniques for, like, amputees to get the electrical signals back to the arms and legs, the prosthetic devices.
You know, which website, JPL?
Boy, Trina, do you? Or Jane?
Maybe Jane. I know we have a technology transfer website. The two that for the Cassini, the one that I always use that is very direct to Cassini. Cassini in its very, very early R&D spent a ton of money working on the CCDs for the cameras to bring them down in weight, needs for power, and how fast they read out. And basically, that technology went straight into your handheld digital video recorder. You know, these little handheld...
Well, and also on the cameras that you swallow and go through your system these days.
Yeah, that too.
That's a good example.
For overall JPL, I know we've got a lot of stuff with MRI technology. We have a lot of stuff with the Global Positioning Network. But, you know, there is a website somewhere. I will find it. It's called Technology Transfer, and I'll send that out with some of the other answers to the questions we've had today.
There's another, besides the information technology, they just did a blurb on a guy that was doing Joseph Bar Cohen, Trina, who's doing working with the arms.
Hmm.
I would like that, because particularly rehabilitation is one of the interests that I'd take back to D.C. and promote. And I want to take all this time for everybody else, away from everybody else who's on the conference call. But do you have my email address, or do you know who to send it to, or how you're going to do it?
What I'll do is, after something like this, we have a few pieces of information to send out, we send it out in an email that goes
through the full distribution so everyone will get it. As long as you got the original email from Charm Leads inviting you to this, you'll get the follow-up.
All right, great. Thank you.
And if anybody is not getting those emails, just let the charm_leads@cdsa.jpl.nasa.gov, let them know, and we'll add you to the distribution.
Okay.
By the way, serendipitously, the person that asked for the oxidizer and fuel from this last burn, it just popped up in my email from my propulsion engineer.
Oh, okay. So
for a 2.7-second burn, we used 0.3 kilograms of oxidizer, 0.2 kilograms of fuel, and that's about the right mixture ratio. And we used 117 grams of the hydrazine for roll control. We fire the Z thrusters to keep us from rolling too much during a main engine burn.
Great, thank you.
Okay.
I got a related question, actually, about the set and orbit insertion maneuver. If you can go to your slide 26.
Okay.
I've always wondered about the angle, the approach angle here in this diagram on the right. It seems a bit exaggerated to me when I compare it to some other views that I've seen. This accurately represented, you know, the one on the right approaching from the bottom.
Uh-huh. The trick is on the scale of the way you see Saturn in there. It's hard to tell. The best approach pictures I've ever seen were the ones that we did for very specific Saturn orbit insertion talks, where we showed how we shot through between the F and G ring,
yes,
went over the top of Saturn, and then
right,
came back out. And that's probably a much better representative angle than this is.
Yeah, I believe I recall them from an earlier seminar, and they were, I don't know, maybe 10 to 20 degrees, something like that.
That's probably about right.
Yeah, see, because this one gives the impression of 45 degrees.
No,
doesn't seem right at all to me.
Not anywhere near.
Not anywhere near, exactly. Yeah, that's why I didn't. This is a great picture, I believe, except for that one line.
Yeah, and I would use, and if it's not out on the website, I'll attach it to Trina so you can see it. The one where we actually showed what we had to do to fire, where we fired the engines and where we shot through the rings. And you remember during Saturn orbit insertion, we actually had to turn the high gain into the ram direction because, of course, the rings are a dust hazard on both sides.
Great. Yeah, I like this. It's very high resolution, too. This is much better than what's on the public website.
Oh, good.
And, yeah, that's nice what's on the website, but not this clear. And also the fact that you added the Titan orbit and Iapetus orbit. That's very good for perspective.
That I didn't do that. I got these from the mission planners. So,
well,
I tell you, even as an engineer, it took me a long time to kind of understand this picture. But once I did, it was like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, the one on the left really shows the pedals. Yeah.
Yes.
Julie, a question about the orbital tour in the future, and this probably might lap into the next telecon we have about what future extended missions might do. But just from a Delta V available after the primary mission, can you give us some ideas of what some possibilities would be with Delta V, not necessarily what's being planned, but how much could you do? Could you go swoop low by the rings? Could you get something closer to orbiting Titan? What is possible?
Yes. We're gonna hopefully, if everything goes right over the next year and a half, almost 2 years, we're gonna have about 250 meters per second Delta V left. And don't quote me on that, because it can be anywhere from 250 to 300 depending on how we do and what our measurements are and how we repressurize. But we're going to have that's quite a bit of Delta V just to fly the trajectory. And I have seen the navigators offer the scientists anything from walking all the way back down from these high inclination orbits and then coming back into an equatorial plane again. I've seen them walk down very quickly, come back around the other side. I think, and this will be up to the scientists to decide, not us. We just tell them what they've got available to them. but there's quite a push to be more conservative in the use over the next few years and get us out into the tell me Trina, we're Saturn winter and we want to go to Saturn spring, or we're Saturn spring.
Yeah, basically the start of the mission was roughly sometime in the middle of, you know, quote, January. And we're only going to end the mission sometime, I think, in, you know, the equivalent of February. And they would love to get out to spring, which would be, I think, 2010. I could look that up, but...
Yeah, remember the 29-year orbit. They would like us to last longer as we go around the sun. So stay tuned. That'll be decided in the next 6 months.
I thought I've read that you may even have enough fuel to go another 4 years beyond the first four.
It depends on how they use it.
Right.
We've put out tours out there that can use it all up
mm-hmm.
and be done in 2010, and we can put out orbit trajectories. Titans, flying by Titans, very very low costs.
Right.
A lot of thrusters. It costs a lot of my prop to maintain getting back into those Titan orbits. And so if you want to do a lot of Titans and get lots of pictures, those are going to be more costly than flying kind of more leisurely orbit where you might want to take other icy. Oh, getting to the icy satellites for close-ups, again, Enceladus, is, of course, now a critical objective. That's going to cost.
That's going to cost.
Because to target a moon specifically costs a lot more.
Hmm. Well, that's worth it.
I think you'd have a lot of people agree with you on that.
Yeah, I'm an organic chemist, so I'm very excited about that.
I started out my life as an organic chemist.
Yeah, Enceladus and Titan are both interesting, but you're saying both of them are kind of like fuel hogs then, huh?
They're more costly.
Mm.
If you want to target, for example, we did the majority of our icy satellite flybys in this past year, and those cost a lot more in terms of larger burns, larger things. The OTM, there are two or three in here that were like on the order of two-minute burns, three-minute burns, four-minute burns. Those were almost all to target special icy satellites.
Huh. So this is really interesting. I hadn't known this part before.
Yeah, it's a little more costly.
Hmm.
Julie, one last question for me.
Sure.
And it's, to what do you owe your success with this piece of equipment in orbit there? Do you think it's the solid-state power management or temperature control, or what is it that makes everything last? It's just been remarkable.
Well, now I'm very, very biased on this subject.
Good. That's what I really want to hear.
I think it's the design, the overall design. If you think about space that for us, you know, we've only really been working space for the last 40, 50 years. And this spacecraft, the designers on this spacecraft, typically had 30 to 40 years of experience as they were designing this spacecraft. We had several major, major subsystem retirees right after we launched Cassini. So there was an incredible amount of experience that was added to that went into the Cassini design. They took a lot of the mistakes of a Magellan. Magellan had some issues with heat problems, and Galileo didn't have heat problems, but they had a really hard thermal management system, and they took that experience and put it into this spacecraft. And so we just had it was the people. We had an amazing amount of knowledge, and my team, which was about 90 people at launch, we're down to about 45 now. The spacecraft engineers themselves, well over a third of my team has been here since pre-launch. They find this a very interesting spacecraft to fly. They find it, you know, one that really works remarkably well. But I think it was the utter experience that went into this design in general.
If you put your finger, though, on a physical factor, do you think it would be thermal control or power management or solid-state circuits?
The power management, the solid-state circuits make our lives considerably easier. Having to go into those operational modes and not worrying about the relays all the time is good. I think the fact that I just don't, you know, of the things that keep me up at night, I never, ever think about, and I haven't since launch, thought about thermal, thought much about power states and things like that, just because they're so reliable mechanically. The things that keep me up at night are reaction wheels.
They keep me up at night, too.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Great mission. Thank you. Great talk.
Do we have any other questions for Julie?
A question.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, how do you deal with the advance in technology from the time you first start designing the spaceship until it's launched, and then, you know, understanding that the Cassini's been in cruise now 7-8 years, technology's advanced. How do you deal with those issues?
You don't. You basically, by the time you launch a spacecraft, now remember, this isn't really true of the newer era, because they're getting to build, test, and launch much quicker than a Cassini. But for example, a Galileo was built on 1970s technology, even though it didn't launch until 1989. Cassini was really designed in the late 80s, early 90s, and you just, some things you can take advantage of, some of the later microprocessors may be a little bit faster and newer, but you design your mission around what you have at the time. We'll never be able, mostly because of the length at Saturn and the size of the antenna, but we would never be able to do what the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter is doing today. We'd never be able to downlink almost terabytes of data in a few days. And you basically take your technology, design your mission around it that you have at the time, and go.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
One more question.
Go ahead.
Sure.
Underside of micro.
Mm-hmm.
Solar wind can damage microcircuitry. How do you factor that into the design?
I don't know about solar winds so much as like radiation and galactic cosmic rays. We've actually been affected by that in two different regions. One, these solid state power switches that occasionally trip off. It's because they didn't really put in enough capacitor in a flip flop circuit. And so galactic cosmic rays are usually the ones that hit us and cause these solid-state power switches to flip off. And that happens at the rate of about 2 per year. So when we found this out, discovered it, realized it, understood that this was going to be an issue, we wrote flight software to look at the telemetry and see if this happened, then react to it. So the answer to if the guy that asked me about the technology is still on the line, that's the real answer, is you make as much of your ability to be reprogrammed in flight and flight software. Again, we did 3 really major reprograms, and each time we took advantage of the things that were giving us fits. So the galactic cosmic ray, solar winds, we are very, very, very radiation hardened, something that most Mars missions, Venus missions don't do. So we just don't get hit with a lot of the single event upsets that a lot of other missions do. And then they just write flight software to work around an SEU. And we have some flight software that's written around SEUs, but mostly we're pre-radiation hardened.
Is that shielding?
Shielding, yes. There's special, like in the bays, that really need to be protected from cosmic rays and the other radiation particles. We actually have brass hardware, and you know the structure itself is aluminum, but we put some brass in certain places. around the cables so that we don't get hit with the, well, this is more not radiation, this is more micrometeorites. We actually braid fairly heavy, thick braided shields around the exposed wiring and cables. The thermal blankets are designed to take a certain thing. The tanks, the thermal blankets actually stand off from all those hydrazine and monoprop tanks by what we call whoop-de-whoops. They're little metal loops that actually cause the blankets to stand off. So if you got if you took a micrometeorite hit on a blanket, for example, it wouldn't get to the tank. So that we do a fair amount of both dust and also the radiation, and we reprogram in flight. We've written some fault protection type things, programs to take care of what we've seen in flight. Okay.
Okay, do we have any other questions? Well, Julie, I'd like to thank you very much. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to talk to folks today. It was a very, very interesting talk and kicks off sort of a year of tutorials we're going to have, which are basic tutorials on the spacecraft and the rings and the magnetosphere that people can really use as background material. So this is the first of our tutorials, and you did a great job. We really appreciate it. Thanks.
Oh, thank you.
And next month, we'll have Dr. Josh Caldwell. He's with the UVIS team. He'll be doing a rings tutorial about the basic structure of the Cassini rings. And then he will also talk about the ultraviolet star occultations that he's involved in and sort of the recent results that have been coming from his UVIS star occultations. So join us at the same time next month. And everybody, have a great month.
Thank you.
Thanks, Trina.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Trina.
Hello.
Thank you for calling the Digital Replay Service.